You're listening to When the Night Comes, a collection of sounds and stories from unsigned Birmingham bands between 1985 and 2005. Musicians go back in time, dusting off old demo tapes and sharing some of the tracks they wrote in bedrooms, garages and studios across the city. My name is Dean Vernals. Series 1, Episode 10 of this podcast covers the work of two Birmingham bands, Renegades and Pavlov Dogs. I'll be joined by three guests who played in both lineups: singer Mark Wildman Wills Wilson, drummer Tim James, and bassist Bob Thacker. The trio first started playing music together in the early 1980s as the James Boys, and two further name changes would follow. After settling on Pavlov Dogs, they would gig extensively and release the Eat Dog EP. Although this resulted in record company interest and decent reviews, the band would remain unsigned. So, let's hear their story. Bob, Tim Wills, great to have you on episode 10 of the podcast.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hello.
Now, although we're focusing on the Renegades and Pavlov Dogs, all three of you started out in another band, didn't you? The James Boys. So let's travel back to 1982, 83 okay. And start there. What do you remember about how you all met, Wills?
Well, I was passing by an antique shop and saw this... this guy polishing a fireplace, and I think somehow we got talking about kind of, you know, being in a band. I was in working with at the time with Bob and another guy, Wiggy, and we had a drummer, and he'd left. And we sort of dragged Tim in, and that was where it kind of started to.
Wasn't it Steve, together. That big, tall Mancunian punk rocker? He mentioned my name, didn't he, to you?
Yeah.
Before that, we were sort of a weird sort of gothic band. I can't even remember the name.
Yeah.
But then Steve left.
And it was a dark room. Journalist.
That's it.
Yeah, and then I suppose where we got Tim in and we had Wiggy playing guitar. He's the mystery figure in all this, really. And that's when we became, I suppose, the James Boys, and then became the Renegades.
And so the James Boys then, did you gig, or was that just rehearsing?
Yeah, we did a few gigs, didn't we?
Played all round Brum for a bit as the James Boys.
I still remember playing the barrel organ several times.
Peacocks, JBs, a mermaid.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. And then, you know, so I think we were kind of, I don't know why we changed our name.
You didn't want everybody to think that it was my band.
I don't think it was that, really. I think it's because there was a group called the James Boys from the 70s that were like kind of...
Now the James Gang, I think, wasn't there?
Yeah, and people were kind of going, oh, you've got country and western old school, you know, and it was like, oh. You know.
It's funny you say that because you chose the name The Renegades, didn't you, for the next move, and there just happened to be another band from Perry Bar, I think, from the 60s, I think, we're called the Renegades as well. Yeah, they were big in Finland, I think, but not so famous in the UK.
Big in Brum, though.
No. So how did you come up with the name the Renegades? Can you remember?
It's a cowboy thing, wasn't it? Wasn't there a film called The Renegades, some old cowboy film?
It was kind of, you know, the idea that you're outside of the, you know, you're outlaws, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, we did wear spurs.
Yeah. And we were, you know, we used to put on, you know, cowboy hats, and Wiggy used to have a little plastic cap gun and stuff like that. We had this idea, I think, of doing sort of fast reggae that was kind of cowboy punk, you know, that kind of thing. So we were getting into that, I think.
Yeah, I think we invented cow punk, didn't we? Borrowed it.
Yeah. A spin-off from goth that was kind of
punk. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I was 16, 17, started going to gigs and rehearsing at Rich Bitch. I mean, I remember seeing Renegades posters everywhere, really, at the time. I mean, you were big on fly posting, weren't you, Tim?
Yeah, well, I used to do it. I used to do fly posters, the record company fly posters. Putting posters up was never a problem.
I remember me and you being chased through town one night by a cop of Wills.
Yeah.
We put some poster up and you just legging it all the way through town down to New Street.
I think a lot of people have got some funny stories about fly posting, haven't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So with this more sort of settled lineup, the Renegades, did you then sort of have your own rehearsal space to develop, Bob?
Yeah, I think around that time we were rehearsing at Rich Bits, but then we sort of migrated down to a place called The Pits in Granville Street. Yeah. And that was run by Fraser Young and Stevie Young, the cousins of Malcolm and Angus from AC/DC. That became our sort of home.
Yeah, it was quite a place. Do you remember that time we were recording? They had a recording studio on the top floor. And we turned up there in the morning to get set up, and they'd got these huge goods doors that they opened, but with about a 60-foot drop. And I started sound checking my drums, and I got my dog with me. Do you remember he tried to leap out the window? Fortunately, Bob sort of rugby tackled him, didn't you? Which was good because he would have died. I felt so bad about that, but he was cool about it afterwards. The dog. So
I presume rehearsing sort of that regularly had an impact on the sound and the sound coming together. Yeah,
we got really tight. You know, we used to rehearse at least three nights a week, and it did.
Let's talk about musical influences then. So, Wills, loud punk sort of springs to mind.
Yeah, I mean punky stuff. I mean, you know, before I joined the Dark Room and all that, I was in Kabuki, which is a kind of. They were a goth band from Birmingham, featuring Max and Matthew and a few other Carbon people. And they went on to become House Gang. They're just releasing in the next couple of weeks the early Kabuki demos with them on.
Interesting.
So that's coming out soon, which was quite interesting. So I've been involved with that, and then finding my own way around it. So. Yeah, I mean, gothy things at that time, I think, you know, there was kind of a lot of Killing Joke and stuff like that was flying around my head, Echo and the Bunnymen, you know, stuff like that. Very eclectic, though, you know, even down to James Brown and people like that were jumping into my head at that time, you know, kind of trying to mix it up. But also hip-hop stuff that we were kind of also trying to get involved in.
I think we all had our own sort of specific influences, completely different stuff. And then when you bunged it all together, it became this sound, this wall of sound.
We didn't really have a plan, did we? Music, we just wanted to make a noise.
No. Well, I was coming on to that, really. How would you sort of describe yourselves to others back in the day, Tim?
I don't know. It's a good question and I can't answer it.
I think we sort of had this, we were quite... We sort of this punk ethic, though, you know, this is what we do, and that's it. If you don't like it, then don't. This is, you know, that sort of thing that, you know, this is what we do. We're not trying to specifically follow anything.
Yeah, but it was all pretty fast, wasn't it? I mean, the drumming was just frantic on all of that stuff. And, you know, between the drums and the bass, it was just like an onslaught, really. I suppose that's how I'd describe it.
I mean, the rhythm section was always sort of in review, said it was extremely tight, rock solid, you know, not blowing our own trumpet, but it was. I had my own influences as a bass player, like bass players who aren't in the background, are like bass players who are like in your face, like, you know, JJ Bunnell from the Stranglers and Peter Hook and John Russell and, you know, even Lemmy. They are the band, and that's what was influencing me at the time.
I mean, we were trying for that kind of, you know, that Who vibe, that kind of, you know, that good British English band vibe. I mean, I think we used a lot of interesting different approaches to music. We were trying our best to kind of do something a little bit different, combine stuff together with a songwriting ethic at the heart of it, I think. You know, there was a real... care about how we constructed our songs, I think.
You know? I was kind of coming on to that, actually, in terms of the songs themselves. Were the different writers in the band, or a typical way of writing, Wills?
It tended to be they'd have a riff going and I'd find words that fitted certain riffs and then from then built a song out of that. So start with the chorus and then after that we'll look at how we fill in the gaps, really, you know, the late and the...
Well, whilst we're on the subject of songs, I think we should hear the first track, actually. So this is a Renegade song, and this one's called Seeing is Believing.
Seeing is Believing.
Was Seeing Is Believing by the Renegades. Now you recorded at a couple of places over, over the different bands, didn't you? Can you remember much about how that one was put down to tape, Bob?
that was recorded at Phil Beard's studio, if I remember, on the Stratford Road. He had a little studio above a sort of junk shop on Stratford Road, like the, literally the size of a front room, with his own 16-track tape deck. And it was just recorded in there over a weekend, if I remember.
Yeah, yeah. And lyrically, Wills, it's like a State of the Nation number, is it?
Well, I still think the lyrics in that one sort of stand up, you know, even today if you listen to it. You know, it was written originally about Thatcher, but it would apply to any of the programs that we have in charge these days.
it's quite a long song, actually. It's over 5 minutes.
Yeah, we could never shut up, really.
Oh, dear. So what do you remember about recording that one, Tim?
We were still finding out about the whole recording process at that point. You know, it was... Yeah, it was good. I mean, it was always good fun. Used to love being in the studio. Well, still do. I know a little bit more about it these days. But, yeah, I think we recorded a few songs there, didn't we?
It was useful to kind of demo stuff up there, you know, as well, even before we went into, say, you know, a bigger studio, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, we did recording there. We recorded at Outlaw, which used to be run by a guy called Phil Savage. We did some stuff at Rich Bitch, and do you remember when we recorded at Outlaw and we had that producer who was quite famous at one point, that Nick Tauber. He produced the One Eyed Jack's album, didn't he, by Spear of Destiny, and he did some early Thin Lizzy stuff. He did quite a bit of stuff, but yeah, he came along and produced some stuff for us, which was interesting.
Now, after a lineup change, Chris replacing sort of Wiggy, you became Pavlov Dogs.
That's right.
Many people know about Pavlov and his experiment. There's also an American band, I think Bob mentioned earlier, with a similar name, wasn't there?
Pavlov's Dog.
That's it. So how did that one come about then? In terms of the name,
I think Fraser at the Pits might have suggested it. But yeah, I mean, it's always difficult thinking of a name, isn't it? You come up with like zillions, and then eventually we stuck with that one.
And in the sort of pre-internet days, there's no way of checking it that there's about five other bands with the same name. And I think with Chris joining the band, the sound sort of evolved. It became a lot harder, I think.
Yes.
Well, Wiggy was always really, he was really into his effects, wasn't he? He loved the Cocteau Twins and all of that kind of really heavily affected guitar sound. And Chris came along and he was a bit more... He was a bit more kind of rock and roll, wasn't he? Although he did seem to rely almost entirely on that digital delay thing that he had.
I think that sort of impressed us, that sort of delay sound. We'd never sort of experienced anything like that. And they sort of gave us a few ideas, you know, and the creative spurt.
Was that the only sort of difference in approach from the Renegades into the Pavlov Dogs, was it?
Wiggy... the original guitarist, he was much more a kind of meandering, like I say, sort of think Cocteau Twins type of thing. The songs could, you know, if you weren't careful, you could have a 10-minute song, you know, whereas when we got together with Chris, it was more about making shorter, punchier songs, really.
Yeah. I think that's it, with a lot of short, punchier, no sort of get rid of all the superfluous stuff.
Yeah.
Like verse, chorus, middle, eight, bang, there you go, next song. There's a bit of Ramones sort of ethic got in there as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, looking at some of the photos of the different lineups, I mean, obviously image is something that was well thought through. You had sort of a gangster look, I think what you'd probably describe as a medieval post-apocalypse phase. There's quite a different lot of things going on in the photos. Obviously the image was a massive part of the scene at the time. How did you go about shaping these different looks? Was it something you sat down and thought about? Or?
Yeah, I mean, we had when we had Pavlov, we released our own 12-inch single, and we got a lot of interest from record companies all over the place, you know. And on the back of that, we were approached by a manager, a guy called Nick Rubenstein, and he said, right, you really need to sort of radically change the image, you know, you need to have something.
Yeah, I remember him saying you just look like four blokes who's ampled onto stage.
Well, we were just four blokes that rambled onto stage looking like some kind of weird post-apocalypse sort of thing. So we did think about it, yeah, because I think it's important. It's got to, it's got to look interesting as well as sound interesting, hasn't it? Yeah,
most definitely. Yeah, I mean, looking back, Wills, do you think did you have a preferred look out of those different images, or?
I think realistically, the gangster looked probably better. But yeah. I don't know.
I think it sort of coincided with them. We also, I mean, me and Chris both had really long hair. We both sort of at the same time coincidentally just cut our hair short. And then we decided, you know, let's put a suit on and see what we look like. And that whole gangster thing came. I don't think we actually planned it.
I think the medieval look was It was a weird because we felt we were being put into something. Do you know what I mean? You know, and we all felt like we were being put, you know, like sort of moulded by someone, and it just felt a little bit naff.
Right.
So when we came out of that, we just went into sort of a gangster look.
Yeah, it was that sort of punk ethic we all always had of basically being unmanageable, you know. Yeah. We'd rather just manage ourselves because people just couldn't go with us.
I couldn't.
Okay.
No.
I know.
Okay, let's hear our second track, actually. This one's called Sweet Dreams.
Lean on me, why don't you lean on me? Lean on me. me, lean on me, lean on me. Why don't you lean on me? Why don't you lean on me?
So that was Sweet Dreams, which was recorded as Pavlov Dogs and also The Renegades. Am I right in saying?
I think we did, yeah. I think we did. But when we recorded it, the version you've just played, that was when we had Nick Tauber on board, and he kind of polished it up a bit, really. And the actual recording was much better, much tighter. And that's what we released as a single, and that's what...
I think that was recorded out.
Yeah, but that got reviewed in Music Week, didn't it? And we had a couple of really great reviews.
This is the as part of the Eat Dog EP, is it? I mean, we'll talk a bit more about that later, actually. But going back to the song, actually, one about getting away from the city. So it was the City of Mayhem, Wills, was it?
Yeah, of course it was. It was escape from all the rubbish that was going on in the city, and it was that idea, I suppose, the sort of dream of escaping,
Didn't we film a video of that in driving through the city? I'm sure we did.
I don't know. I think we might have taken some photographs.
Yeah.
What do you remember? Do you remember much about the recording process for that one? You talked about it being at Outlaw Studios, did you say that?
I think because we had that producer, there was a lot more... because we were just used to just turning up and record, like playing live. But he sort of introduced the idea of overdubbing and constantly, just record it and then go over and redo the bass and redo the guitar and redo the vocals completely separately. So you could actually focus on them a lot more.
Let's have a chat about gigging then now, shall we? We talk loosely about it, but many remember you as a pretty good live act, I think. What do you remember about the gigging experience? I'll start with you, Bob.
They were always... I mean, we played lots and lots of support gigs around Birmingham. I think we were Birmingham's best support band, we were known as for a while. But we got onto like the university, so the Polytechnics, which was at the time a big thing to get onto. And obviously all the big venues we played at, around like the Barrel Organ, the Mermaid, we mentioned, all those venues that were around.
Yeah, mainly Birmingham, but we got out of town, didn't we? We used to play down in London a bit.
Yeah, that was when we were starting, when the management sort of deal started, trying to get us a record deal, and it became more focused on gigging in London to get exposure. Rather than just doing a gig for the sake of doing a gig, there was this purpose that so-and-so is going to turn up or so-and-so might turn up and listen or whatever.
The Um and Amen.
Yeah.
Did we play a showcase to MCA and Sub Pop and people like that?
That was at the Orange Club, wherever that is. Is it in Camden?
Something like that.
I remember we did one at Rich Bitch, didn't we, in their big studio in Sally Oak. We showcased and we videoed the whole thing.
Yeah,
that was a whole
showcase. Okay. I mean, you talked about sort of having playing a lot of support slots, but actually some of them were pretty decent, weren't they?
We supported Ruby Turner at the Town Hall. That was a good one.
That was some
benefit gig, I think. I can't remember what it was. But I remember that night we played the Town Hall, and then we drove up and played the Mermaid on the same night.
That was supporting John Cooper Clarke at the Mermaid.
John Cooper Clarke, who else did we...
That Petrol Emotion.
The Poppies we did a lot of work with. Do you know what I mean?
We played with them before they were Populate Itself. They were Wild and Wandering, weren't they?
That's it, yeah. And I remember the night they changed their name. JB's Dudley, And they came to us and they said, we've pulled all our gyros and we've managed to get the pressing of this record. And you know, it's gone on to be, I wish I'd bought one that night, actually, because they're worth quite a bit of money now.
Yeah. It was in a brown paper bag, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they've got a little John Bull printing set and printed the Poppy Say Grr on the little brown paper bags. I thought it was really cool, actually.
Yeah, it was.
Mm. But back in the day, there used to be quite a lot of these Battle of the Bands things going on as well. I believe you got to the final one, yeah, didn't you? It was the old Dame nightclub, I believe.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, I managed to reverse my van into the manager's car and wrote it off. and then which was absolutely terrible because BR&B were recording it, weren't they? It was a live recording.
Yeah. I think we entered that company just for a laugh. I remember we paid this 30 quid entrance fee to Brumby in pennies. Yeah. Yeah, that's great sack of pennies and just went and emptied it on the desk. Yeah. And said, there you go. That's our entrance fee.
Yeah, we were a real pain in the arse, weren't we?
Because the thing was, we played that gig, and it was great. We had everyone on the floor dancing and running around, and we were quite triumphant, really. And then Cohesion came on, who were our opponents. And no one danced, no one really clapped or anything. And then Roy Wood was the deciding judge, and he voted for them rather than us, and everyone went, "What?" It was outrage, you know. Cause
that's the night, the famous incident of the toilet, the dressing room toilet just flooded, and it sort of became apocryphal then that we'd trashed the whole dressing room and threw the toilet down the stairs, something like that, wasn't it?
No, the cistern just fell off the wall, didn't it?
That's it, something like that. that's the reputation followed us around then. That we trashed places.
It was rubbish, rubbish, really. But you know, what are you going to do?
Well, didn't your fan base get quite a reputation as well? It didn't go down too well at one gig at Birmingham Uni, I believe. Is that right?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Where we let them all in through the window because of them. It was a uni. It was one of the sort of freshers gigs, I think, and they weren't allowed in. Like hardcore fan without having someone to sign them in, a student. So we just opened the dressing room window and let them all in.
I mean, one sort of big gig, which we haven't mentioned, was in Amsterdam, wasn't it? How did that happen?
Well, Tim? A friend of ours who was a drummer in Ash Gang kind of came to an end, and he moved out to Amsterdam, and he started promoting music at a place, I think it was called the Korsakoff. And he just got us out there, and it was the idea was to go out there and play a gig and get some more gigs off the back of it, which would have happened, but for some reason it didn't. I think it was just too much hassle getting out there and all the rest of it. So, but yeah, it was a good night that. Yeah, well, we were out there for a few nights, weren't we?
Yeah, I think that was a real boys' own adventure. Like everyone piled in the van. Drove down to Harwich over the ferry, drove down to Amsterdam.
Yeah. I was driving, I'd had enough by the time we got to Amsterdam because everyone was messing around. I left the group.
I did sleep
in the van, but I didn't want to sleep in the van. I just didn't want to leave all the gear and everyone went, "We're going for a bit." I said, "Well, I'll stay with the van." And everyone went, "All right," and just left me there. So I had to sleep in the van in the street in Amsterdam, which was great. Yeah, one of the best nights of my life, that was. Yeah.
Well, we were all visiting the coffee bars.
Well, when I left the van, when we got to Amsterdam, I went to a coffee shop and had a coffee, I suppose you'd say. And then I decided to rejoin the band. That was good.
My memories of it was kind of selling your posters in the street in Dam Square.
I think that's how we funded the whole thing, wasn't it? We had a load of posters.
We took some record company fly posters and sold them.
The gig was amazing, though. It was a really, really storming gig. It was really, there was some, you know, it was full up, this venue, people on the balcony, and it was just like everyone really responded.
People actually jumping off the balcony, weren't
they? Yeah. That whole gig. I mean, I was wearing gold sprayed DMs, and it was just—it was a really, really good gig. I think, although at the beginning, I think Chris's guitar delay pedal didn't work, or he hadn't got the right settings, so it put us off a bit. But by the end, we were storming it. And we did Anarchy in the UK as our encore, and the place just went off like a fantastic.
Yeah, thinking back to the gig, would you have played our next track, Heart Attack?
No, we'd have definitely played that.
That year we always opened with that. That was our first song.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to it. That was Heart Attack by Pavlov Dogs, which was also on the Eat Dog EP. What do you remember about how that one came about, Bob?
That was literally when we set up in the rehearsal rooms, messing around and started scratching the strings. I used to have this habit of cleaning the guitar strings. I would scratch them. And Will's just said, "Do you like scratching?" or something like that. And then Tim just joined in with his mad beat and it just evolved. It's one of them moments that just happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we just took it from there.
And lyrically, Wills?
I suppose this is the Heart Attack. It's the idea of kind of don't mix your drugs, basically. I'd done some work with a drug prevention thing for a while, and, you know, the kind of key message was, that, you know, if you're going to do drugs, don't mix them without knowing what they can do, you know, and that was the message, really.
Yes, yeah.
You know, the idea behind it, don't mix.
Yeah, yeah. And Tim, what do you remember about the recording process itself for that track?
Not a great deal, to be honest.
I think we recorded it on about four or five different occasions, really, because we were trying to get it right, I think. I can't remember what with that particular one.
I think we recorded that one finally at Outlaw with Phil Savage. We just tried to shove everything into every song, basically.
I think that was it. It was like maximum, you know, everything. There was no space for anything. You know, there's a bit of a gap there. I'll just put something else and fill it up.
I remember saying to Phil Savage, "Can we find a shipping forecast so that we can put the shipping forecast in?" And everybody went, "What on earth are you talking about?" And I said, So I went into the studio and just did a kind of a version just to give an example of what I was talking about. And he recorded it. And it's in there, yeah.
Talking about the EP itself, that was a sort of self-funded sort of 12-inch single, was it?
Yeah.
And how did the idea for that come about? You just kind of thought, well, we need to sort of do something to promote ourselves in a bit of a different way, or?
At the time, you know, the idea of putting a record out yourself was quite a thing. And I suppose we were sort of inspired by Populate itself. They put all their gyros together and recorded that. And we thought, you know what, we've just got to do this thing. So we did a similar thing.
Yeah.
And except I think we just used all of Bob's gyros. Mm-hmm. And then,
still paying them back.
Yeah, we never recouped.
But a lot of it, we screen printed the covers ourselves. I remember I nicked the paper. I was working at the Evening Mail at the time. I'll admit to that.
That's right. Yeah, and then we stuck all of the sleeves together ourselves, didn't we?
And numbered them all and all. So.
It was
a little cottage industry, sort of sitting there folding these covers and sticking the vinyl in and everything.
As lots of people used to do, I guess. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And again, it's kind of come full circle.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, it managed to pick up some airplay out in Seattle, didn't it?
I'm not sure. I think it did all right on college radio out in the States.
It sort of got picked up by some station here. I can't even remember who told us that.
These days we'd be able to find out.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we should hear another track, actually. One from the archives you've chosen. This one's Kingdom Stone. So that was Kingdom Stone by Pavlov Dogs. And
Lyrically, that's a deep one, Wills, that one.
Yeah, isn't it? I love that one. I think we were kind of going on a sort of Stone Roses tip there a little bit.
Yeah,
so we were kind of, I think there was that kind of vibe going on. We were kind of interested in that sort of, you know, the emerging Manchester scene a bit, but we were still trying to keep it Pavlov, you know. It was kind of that same thing, you know, and it was, but yeah, I thought it's a good little song, that one, and it's all about sort of the basics in life, DNA, you know, the fundamentals.
And so, yeah, there's that, some of that comes like that quirkiness of Devo, like the stuff that they were on about, you know, that sort of influence.
I'm a big Devo fan even now, you know, and, you know, that sort of music was kind of, you know, coming into the catchment, I think, you know, looking at different ways to do stuff, you know, make it a bit more slightly dance beat, I think, that one.
Yeah, so the sound was evolving a little bit is what you're saying, I guess, there.
Yeah, I'd say. Yeah, starting to find ways of writing songs.
You
know, we were struggling, I think, at the time. It was quite difficult for me to kind of, I tried a lot of times to work with Chris to sort of get him to work with me on songs, but I found that it was better to do it as a band rather than just me and him sort of sit there and try and do a Lennon McCartney sort of thing. So, you know, I found that writing with the band was always much
more
productive.
Do you remember much about the actual recording process for that one at all, Bob?
That was done at the bunker, if I remember. In Bearwood. An old nuclear bunker.
I remember that.
The place we ended up rehearsing.
That was cool, that place.
It's a really nice place. You just wouldn't know it was there. You drive past and there's just a little hole in the side, like a hobbit doorway, and you just go down it.
It was a World War II installment, wasn't it, for civil servants, like a kind of underground air raid bunker. It was fantastic.
I think, going back to what Will said about trying to get that more of a dance beat, I think Tim just started playing a beat. And Play four bass notes going down. All right, here's four notes going down. And then it sort of evolved from that, the music side of it. And then obviously Will starts thinking, putting his vocals on top of it. I think a lot of the best songs did just came about like that. Rather than, when we started to try and sit down and force it, like Will's was just saying, it just didn't work.
Yeah, we just used to turn up and make noise and then... And occasionally, some of it would make sense.
You'd remember it the next time. I think, that sounded good.
The ones that were good, you'd remember.
You know? Yes, indeed.
Go, let's do that one again and develop them that way. And I felt it was much, much better to have that organic. Because I think, really, you know, looking back on it now in retrospect, I think, you know, we were really a bass and drum-driven band, and that was the key core of it, you know.
And
I think that's what I needed to work off of rather than the guitar, you know, so.
Yeah.
It was always that really rock solid rhythm section and everything else sat on top of it. And you had to have that rhythm underneath.
Yeah.
Now, earlier you touched on the subject of record company showcases, didn't you? FM Revolver were keen. There was definitely interest there, wasn't there?
Yeah, lots of interest, you know, lots of kind of teasing and.
I think ultimately, we scared a lot of people that didn't actually think, you know, there's still a lot of talent there, and undoubtedly there was, but I think a lot of management teams of record companies were quite sort of wary of, you know, what we were.
Hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? Reflecting on it now, what do you think some of the missing ingredients might have been?
I think the fact that the record industry wasn't interested in... taking on a band like us that would need quite a lot of work with no obvious target audience. We were more of a sort of avant-garde type of...
Yeah, I think what happened at the time, you had sort of the whole Manchester thing blew up after Oasis, and then record companies just went and looking for other bands like that, and then the whole dance music, I mean, the same thing. No one wanted to take a punt on someone who was just a bit different.
Yeah,
or didn't fit in anything.
We didn't have a game plan. We just loved playing music and making a noise.
Yeah,
and I think that is probably what worked against us in terms of, you know, getting a record deal. We weren't interested in being a pop band, and we weren't interested in troubling the charts. So perhaps that's the reason.
Yeah. I mean, one sort of other thing that sort of went on around that time was you had a session at Radio WM.
Yeah, well, a great fan of ours and a top bloke as well was a guy called Paul Flower. And he had a show on Radio WM. Yeah. I mean, he was involved in a lot of things. He used to put gigs on at a place called the Cod Club, where we used to play quite regularly. Yeah. And he just got in touch with me about 3 months ago and said, I've found this tape of when you did this session at Radio WM, which was broadcast on Radio WM as part of his show. And we went in there and did a live session.
The WM thing's at Pebble Mill, the old Pebble Mill studio, and that was a massive, massive, you know, proper orchestra size studio, wasn't it?
Massive.
And us four in the middle of it.
That's
like
it. But no, Paul Flower just he just got us in to do that because he liked the band. Paul Flower's a great guy, really supportive of a lot of Birmingham bands at that time and still now, to be honest.
Indeed. Okay, I think we should probably have take a listen to our sort of final track now. And that's one that sort of was probably perhaps the last song you recorded as a group, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Bunker, that was Itching. Don't lose your head.
Okay, so that was Ching by Pavlov Dogs. What do you remember about that one, Wills?
I think it was a sort of drug thing. I think there was a reference to drugs again in there. I think. But it's also about kind of mental health and issues like that, you know, the sort of itching brain, you know, you kind of, you know, you get this kind of feeling sometimes and it's, you know, it's difficult to deal with and kind of, you know, and then we were trying to recreate that feeling in the song, I think.
Yeah, I think musically I remember that, but that bass line that opens it, that's just what I used to do when I'd sound check. Just crank my amp up full just to get the special Thacker sound and play them two notes and slide it down because I could get the feel of it, and it just sort of grew from that.
Yeah, that song came together in about 5 minutes, really, didn't it? You know.
Yeah, literally. I think we sort of threw that together the day we were in the studio, sort of sound checking or, you know, just setting up, and that sort of grew. So we thought, you know, we'd record that because, like I said, it's one of them best songs. It just grew instantly, sort of organically.
Well, we've heard a selection of tracks now, various songs over the years. Looking back on them all, I guess, are they as sort of good as you remember, Bob?
I think they are. When I first heard them, because Will started putting together this archive of the sounds a few years back, and I discovered his website, and it was on there, and started listening to them. Bloody hell, it's as good as I remember.
Yeah.
It'd be great to go and play them again, but without a guitarist.
Yeah, and like being half deaf and with acute tinnitus, it becomes hard. Let that be a warning to you youngsters out there.
Indeed.
Stand by Bob's bass speakers.
Yeah, it'd end up like me.
Now, although we often choose to record certain tracks at the time, looking back, do you think you recorded your best material?
Yeah, I think so.
There's one track I always remember called, and we'll have to swear now, it's called Shit Hot.
Oh, right.
And it was just drum and bass, and it was, if you remember it, Tim, it was just absolutely full on.
Yeah.
And it really sort of woke you up. It just hit you like a truck. That's one I wish we'd recorded.
Well, I was always a big fan of Budgie's drumming from Susie and the Banshees. That sort of more kind of tribal soundy stuff. And there's a few tracks that we had that were, you know, I wouldn't say drum led, but drum heavy. And we never recorded those. And there's probably one or two tracks I can think. We had a track called Zuma, which I really used to like playing. So, yeah, I mean, there's always stuff you think, you know, maybe we should have done that, maybe we should. But, I mean, all of those songs made it into our live performance. So never really gave it that much thought,
There's a lot of recordings, because we used to have a little ghetto blaster, didn't we, that we put in the rehearsal room. And it actually recorded really well. I mean, it just had that tiny little hole for the microphone. And there's the four of us going full blast, all that sound just going into that tiny little microphone.
Yeah.
It actually sounded pretty good. So there's a load of them tapes around somewhere.
I mean, now, sadly, the band broke up around 1995. Yeah. If you were forming again in 2022, all the different ways to promote yourselves, do you think you'd probably be more successful today?
Possibly. I mean, I think that the whole music scene has changed in terms of the way that people listen to and buy music, and a lot of it's online. So I think that, you know, building a website or, you know, this type of thing, going on the various platforms, TikTok and all the rest of it, you know, maybe, but
yeah, it's a lot easier to get sort of yourself out there now. I mean, the only, literally in our day, it was four men in a van and turn up and play somewhere.
Now you
just shove something on Spotify or on the internet or Instagram, TikTok, whatever, and you're out there to thousands of people instantly.
I can see elements of what we were trying to do in bands like the Idols now, you know, people like that. You know, that was where our heads were at, really, I suppose, a little bit, you know, but it was kind of not fully formed like they are, you know, and not marketed like they are, you know, but, you know, we did have, you know, that same sort of dynamic that that band's got, for instance, I think, you know.
Yeah. Interesting. So, I mean, a couple of you are involved in music still today then. Tim, you're in a band now. Klein just played a gig.
Yeah. Since Pavlov Dogs kind of finished, I've done a few things. Yeah. I was in a band called Blessed Ethel for a while. various other things, quite a lot of things, but more notably, I suppose, I played with a band called The Godfathers for about 6 years. That ended about 2.5 years ago. And more recently, I'm doing a band called Klein, which is all original material. Yeah. And that's going good. We're recording an album. So, yeah, still doing it.
And Wills, are you sort of involved in music at all now?
Yeah, I've done some work with a dance music thing.
Yeah.
Sat in an Oakmont for a few years. And then bugged it off. I do my own production now, so I do some Wild Band Wills stuff, which I put out on the normal platforms.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of that. And I've also been doing production with my stepdaughter, who's called Miss Mesto, who's a rapper.
Oh, right.
She played the Isle of Wight Festival this year.
Yeah, right.
In with all the Slambury crew and helping them with different video pieces and stuff like that. So, so I'm still kind of ducking and diving in the music industry in some way. It's not quite the same. I'd love to be able to do what I was doing. You know,
yes, yeah.
But as you get older, it's harder.
And do you still dabble a bit, Bob?
I sort of moved away from music completely, went into education, teaching computer science.
Yeah.
I still play, guitar around the house, but nothing sort of professionally.
On a final note, what would you like to take away from your time in the band? Let's start with you, Wills.
Some great times with some brilliant blokes. I had such a lovely time. I mean, there were ups and downs, but it was just, I had such a great time, and we lived the way we wanted to play the music, and we had no compromise, and that was good. You know, we didn't find fame or make money or have a big album or something, but we did what we wanted to do, and it was fantastic.
Yeah. Very profound.
I'd second that. It's just that idea of there's four blokes. It's like four blokes against the world, really.
Yes.
And then, we had this whole sort of ethos. There's a lot of sort of hype of being really scary and mad and dangerous. And, a friend of mine I've shown some pictures to not long ago, and she said, if I saw you coming down the road, I'd run away. it was all made up completely, but it's just that whole ethos of four blokes against the world, and if you don't like us, then that's fine by me.
Yeah. I just think you were just all so lazy, and if you'd listened to me, then things could have been so different. I totally agree with what Will said. I mean, we had the best time, and our rehearsal nights were just like party nights, and we'd play some great music, and we'd have a really good time, and then we'd go down to the Powerhouse usually, or somewhere, or if we were at the Pits, it was good fun, really really good fun.
Yeah,
great. On that note, that's all we got time for, I'm afraid. So, I mean, you've been great guests. Thanks for sharing your stories and allowing the tracks to be heard again. So, finally, long live the music of the Renegades and Pavlov Dogs.
Excellent.
Thanks, Dean. Nice one.
Thanks, Dean. Brilliant.
When the Night Comes was written and produced by me, Dean Vernals. If you've enjoyed the music in this episode, or were in a Birmingham band and would like to share your story, then get in touch at wtncpodcast@mail.com. That's wtncpodcast@mail.com. You can also see photographs of the bands involved on our Twitter account. Just search When the Night Comes. I hope you can join me for the next episode. And thanks for listening.